I've been working on all of my days, and I've been trying to find what's been in my mind as the days keep turning into night.
You're listening to Dig Deep on KAXE, KBXE. Chuck Marone and Aaron Brown. We're continuing this conversation. We just talked about how we hear people saying it's never been this bad in terms of political discourse and people with differing opinions. Now we're going to talk about that it is this bad.
Well, it's different.
Yeah, in a sort of a different time. We had mentioned in the last segment that you talked about a teacher showing an educational video. I heard from a friend they don't have TV, they're not exposed to a lot of things, and she was asked, why do people hate Joe Radinovich so much? And she had no idea where he would have seen
this. My mom asked the same question.
Yeah.
And she's a very intelligent woman. She just doesn't watch a lot of media, doesn't spend any time on the internet. And so when these ads show up, she's taken aback by, what on earth did he ever do?
It's funny because my kids they live in a household of people who, you know, my wife and I are engaging and have a lot of conversations and include our kids. One of the things that came up at the dinner table was why is Joe Radinovich basically like a deadbeat? Like, why doesn't he pay his bills? And I'm like, what are you talking about?
Talking about dad? Did they find out about?
Well,
about
no, I didn't. We didn't go there.
Yeah.
But you know, we covered this on our last podcast. Yeah. Extra.
Tune into last month's podcast,
right?
For the tales of Chuck's.
Yeah, but rough, you know, years. It's like, okay, come on, kid. Like, you're not. Wow, is this what you're? Here was my reaction. I don't want to sound like elitist in this way. We have a real robust conversation in our house on a lot of issues. I looked at my kids and said, what do kids who don't have that, what are they growing up believing? Because at least we're having like...
Uh-huh. We're able to put these things in context.
In some context, yeah. Mm-hmm. And have some conversation. Like, what if, you know, you're going from Fortnite to YouTube to bed, and in between you're getting like bombarded with these crazy ads and crazy messages. Like, what is that person going to be like as a U.S. voting citizen in 10 years?
Yeah, I think when we talk about what's changed, it is that element of you can't avoid it. Those ads are on the little screens at the gas station when you pump up
gas.
I know you and I go to the holiday stations quite often, and I know that's one of the places where you can see them. And they show 10-second negative or 15-second negative ads while you're pumping your gas. And for a lot of people, and there's all kind of direct mail is another thing that's become more popular because it goes to everybody and it goes into your home and you can't just mute it. It comes in. And so as marketers, essentially political marketers, are finding these new avenues of sharing these mostly negative messages, mostly designed to make you feel emotionally a certain way so that your behavior can be predicted. In other words, maybe you vote for our guy because you don't like the other guy, or better yet, just stay home. It doesn't matter, you know, and we'll motivate the people who are highly motivated to go out and vote for our candidate. Whatever the case may be, you can't avoid it. It's always part of you. And because it's so pathos, emotional driven, you know, it becomes kind of psychological. It becomes part of how we think. Oh, God, I woke up today and my party wasn't in the White House and my party doesn't control Congress. And yeah, the sun's shining, but man, I feel tense. I feel anxious because I don't know what that might mean for me and the things that I think are important. It might mean really bad things. And I would say that describes a lot of people, liberals and Democrats that I know now. And I'm certain that it applied to conservatives just as much when Obama and the Democrats won back in 2008. And people felt it on a very profound emotional level, like beyond reason. Yes, you could just go to work and do your thing and love your family and serve your community and, you know, whatever organizations you support. You could just do that and live a happy life. But they weren't, because something seemed off. And that, I think, is the pervasive nature of our media and the way it's become so hardwired to our brain. I keep saying that this is the era of marketing, and that Trump is just an example of a marketer who's caught the right wave at the right time. But we live in an era where we're being convinced with a total sensory overload at all times to do things, to believe things, and behave a certain way, because a lot of people in power profit and maintain their power when we do this.
I was thinking about child abductions. Because if I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay, good.
Because I think back in the, you know, back when we were kids, they would put like the kid on the milk carton, mm-hmm. like this kid's missing, mm-hmm. you know, like, okay, thanks for ruining my lunch. You know, like I'm terrified now.
Draw little mustaches on him.
Well, you sit down to lunch and you're like, kid, at any point you could be abducted by a stranger, mm-hmm. you know. And we were kind of, all of a sudden, we became aware of child abductions. I mean, they were everywhere. Jacob Wetterling, of course, was one of the national examples that was here locally in Minnesota. If you look at child abductions, they're extremely rare. Child abductions by strangers
is really rare.
Even rarer, they're very rare. If you are a parent with a child, you are like infinitely more likely to bring harm to your child driving them to Walmart than you are letting them go play in the park. I mean, that mm-hmm. statistically, they're not even in the same realm. Yet we became so hyper aware of child abductions that we have basically developed a society that limits children's exposure to being alone, to going out and play, to all these things. That's the reaction. And you can see decades later, the counter reaction to that. Mm-hmm. We have very high rates now, growing rates of child suicide, of youth depression. We're suffering from a whole bunch of things that psychologists are saying are directly related to the fact that young people are not able to have kind of independent play, independently work things out, grow in independent ways at young ages like children for thousands of years have.
And the sense of community that you form with other people.
Yes.
You know, different people, yes. But like the idea that you would get together and there'd be a group of your friends and you would get together on a regular basis and you would get together independently of your parents' permission.
Right.
You know, or whatever. You would actually just fundamentally gather as a community that you've formed. And actually, you mentioned those problems. I mean, addiction research is increasingly showing that isolation is one of the big triggers of addictive behavior. Well,
this is where I'm going with
this.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because I
sense that.
You look at it, and I think now what has happened is, like, the fish is unaware of the water they're in. We've become just surrounded by, at holiday on the film thing, when you turn on the radio, when you just try to read like the comics in the newspaper, like whatever it is, even if you try, like I do, to take intentional steps to separate yourself from it, it is impossible to separate yourself from it. It's the sea we swim in. You combine that with the fact that we have now created and evolved our living pattern where you don't have to come into contact with anyone for most things.
Yeah.
You don't have to come with contact with someone to pump gas, to mm-hmm. get money from the bank, to buy your insurance, to buy your groceries. I mean, for crying out loud.
They'll come to your house.
They yeah. actually deliver to your house now. You can go through life not only not having to have a real interaction with someone who disagrees with you on a topic, and in other words, hear a contrary view from someone you might respect. You don't have to have that problem. You don't even have to interact with someone you agree with. We have so isolated ourselves mm-hmm. from each other. And I think that the humans have not changed. I think what happened is the sea we swim in has changed and the isolation of it mm-hmm. has changed. And I do think that is, in a way, changing who we are as people.
Yeah.
In ways that are fundamental and are showing up in some of these statistics. Depression, sense of loss, sense of hopelessness, suicide rates.
And the additional breakdown of the family. I don't just mean the nuclear family, but I think about how when I was a kid and I was as a teenager, I decided I was liberal and I couldn't help who I was. And I became a liberal.
You came out as a liberal.
I came out. And now my family is, that wasn't like a horrible thing in my family.
We accept
you. There were a number
of
other liberals.
Now some media could get that and twist that.
I know, right?
Get your quote right there.
Well, there it is. Well, it's too late for me. Okay. Yeah, it's too late for me. The quotes are out there. But I was a liberal guy and I had some very conservative relatives. And this is normal, you know, this is normal. A lot of families have divides within the family, especially among extended families. And I remember having spirited, maybe amusing, fun political conversations with my relatives. We would, I've talked about this before, we would joke about it. They would get me gag gifts that were conservative. You know, a family friend, deer hunting, they would put Wellstone signs on his deer stand, you know, because it was, it amused them to watch him scream and yell and holler. And so things like this were common, and it was kind of good natured. And yeah, nobody, they didn't vote, didn't change anybody's vote, but they were among a community of people, a family.
You were in a sense humanizing.
Yeah.
Your what has now become your opponent.
The relationships were more important than the differing political views.
Right.
And now what I see is how, especially with social media, is I'm not saying that we aren't still a family, but what I am saying is that we don't talk about politics anymore.
Right.
Because it's gotten really bad when we do. And online, I've watched cousins, relatives melt down with each other over politics. I have decided, even though I'm I try to inform myself, I talk about this on the radio. I can talk about it here on the radio, but I don't try, you know, when it comes time for the family get-together, it's like, no, I'm not going to even bring it up. And if they bring it up, I'm going to change the subject because it's unpleasant. And the reality of this is...
Exact same.
And the reality of it is, I think, is that the sad part of this is because it used to be that the relationships were stronger than the political ties. Now I feel like because of we're isolated and surrounded by this constant stream of political rhetoric and we self-select the stuff that makes us feel good, we have a closer relationship with our phone and the meme, the political memes that our phone shows us or our Facebook friends who all believe the same thing. We have a closer relationship with that than we do with our uncle or our cousin who disagree with us politically. And I think that's just creating all kinds of problems in our society.
So I'm going to give a trigger warning right now because I'm about to go full-blown conservative on
okay,
you.
Okay, let's...
And actually like get into... For me, what has happened here is that we have, in a sense, reduced... As part of our kind of centralized political system, we have replaced our relationships with each other, which are messy, which are tough, which are difficult, which are not always fun. We have replaced that. We've replaced our relationships within our community with a relationship with the state largely being the federal government. In other words, I wake up in the morning, it's more important to me who my president is than who my mayor is. We've replaced it with a fear of losing my Social Security benefits at the federal level, having Medicare changed, having my, you know, road not funded by Washington, D.C., whatever, like the hyper concern, you know, Nancy Pelosi's going to make you pay for someone's abortion.
Or
you know,
take someone's guns away.
Yeah, whatever, take your guns away. Whatever it is, mm-hmm. my relationship is to the state, the centralized state. Washington, D.C., and to a lesser degree, the state capital as a surrogate of that, as opposed to with my neighbor, the person across the street, the pastor at my church, the people who are on the city council and the school board, the business owners down in the downtown. They are now less important in my day-to-day life than the centralized state is. And I think if you are a big government person, I think if you are a progressive liberal, the central government can solve like all these local problems. This is like an ideological victory. You have won. You have now kind of mediated out all of the kind of local, parochial, hierarchical, nasty, messy, difficult concerns that we have at the local level. And you can just mediate directly with the central government. And I think that this is a natural outcrop of that kind of thing.
I don't think it feels like a victory.
No, I don't think it feels
for liberals or progressives. And I don't know that, you know, we could argue perhaps that this is an unintended consequence of talking so much about the federal government. But on the other hand, it seems like this began in response to, or maybe didn't begin, but like our current state of situation seems like the era started with President Obama being elected in 2008, maybe to a lesser extent George W. Bush and his presidency post 9/11, maybe a little bit of that, and then it became more amplified during Obama, and it's more amplified now during President Trump's administration, this notion of the ever-present politics. And I don't know that it began as so much because we had strong opinions about the government. I think a lot of people don't even really understand or know or want to talk much about policy specifics. And we talk about that a lot. You and I can find out exactly where we disagree on a political issue. And maybe we don't change each other's minds, but maybe we outline a few things that we could work on. And I think anybody in Congress, even today, could do that, Democrats and Republicans. But they are pushed instead by a very powerful populist, you know, hurricane of political support that wants them to fight, that wants them never to compromise or identify third ways of doing things. And that comes not from a desire to have a centralized state, but from a desire to fit in and belong and have everybody believe the same thing. And that's a psychological thing. And I can't tell. I'm not going to say you're wrong because I don't know. I can't tell where that came from.
So for me, when I look at the one thing that Democrats and Republicans at the federal level have in common is, I'm going to say two things. One, their desire to retain power. And two, their desire to have power. So centralize power with them there and keep it. I'll pick on Republicans because I think it's very easy to do in this context because they're in power right now. Republicans throughout the entire Obama administration, the number one issue was the federal deficit. Obama's a huge spender. The deficit's a big deal. We're going to bankrupt the country. Cut, cut, cut. We can't do any of these things. Republicans gained total power in Washington, D.C. What are we doing? We're running trillion-dollar deficits. We don't even talk about the deficit anymore. It's insane. It's crazy. And by the way, it is actually starting to bite. Interest rates are going up. Our interest expenses are going up.
They'll talk about it during the first day of the next president's
administration. Absolutely. Whenever a Democrat takes office, we'll be back to deficit again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Is it because they deeply care about the deficit? Is it because they don't care about the deficit? Or is it because talking about the deficit in the way that they do actually enhances their power? Not resolving issues actually enhances their power. Keeping us in a continual state of frenzy actually grows their power.
I've often, like the NRA and other issue-based lobbies, I often feel like the NRA's best situation for keeping power is to have either divided government or a Democratic president, because there is a constant boogeyman.
You have to have a boogeyman
to be right. Put out there. And if you look at the Obama years, how many gun control measures were put into effect?
Zero.
I don't think any. Yeah. I don't think a single one. I don't think anybody's gun was taken away.
I got
away.
A constant stream of letters and emails.
But the NRA
stuff,
right. became a very much more powerful organization during that time, despite the school shootings, despite all of the political maelstrom that followed this great national tragedy that's happening still. But because they could point out an enemy that certain people felt was the enemy, they could use that to control power. So it's, even though the Republican Party, you know, argues that it's not for bigger government, it likes to define itself in relation to a big government.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think if you are Mitch McConnell, if you are Nancy Pelosi, just to pick the two like evil people that each side castigates, you are happy. You are doing your job for your party if you can have the obsession of voters being what happened in the Kavanaugh hearings as opposed to who their local judge they're voting for is. Mm-hmm. When the reality is whatever Kavanaugh does is going to have zero, almost no negligible, no noticeable impact on your life. And what happens in your local judge, you could potentially be standing in front of this person at some point. Their integrity, their values, what they are so much more important to you. You don't even know their person's name. You're going to show up at a voting booth with this whole long list of judges, and you're not going to have heard of any of them, but you know all these intimate details about a person whose impact on you is going to be, if anything, part of a glacial trend at the federal level.
Yeah, and if you look at in the 8th District, like where has the impact been recently, towns and places that are doing cool stuff, it's almost always at the local level. Duluth and other places that have had little booms of success, it's these local people that, you know, we don't pay as much attention to.
All right, we'll try to find some hope in our next segment.
We've got
Dig
it. We've got
Dig
it.
Deep as we talk political discourse.
Oh, there's
discourse.
No hope. There's no hope.
Oh, no, there is.
There's hope. Oh, we'll
I'm pro-hope. Hear that. Love my days. I cried aloud, I shook my hands at what I'm doing here. Oh, love these days. For I look around me and my eyes confound me, and it's just too bright.
keep turning into